faces a choice. This is Battleground America. Here's Tara Servatius.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Insane Things Podcast, where we wrap up the week that was. Great to listen to while you're puttering around on the weekend, doing your errands, that boring stuff you gotta knock out. All right, we'll dive right in. Insane thing number six. We spent over 20 years in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban. We spent $2.3 trillion fighting the Taliban. Our troops took 20,000 injuries fighting the Taliban. And tragically, heartbreakingly, 2,456 U.S. military personnel died in Afghanistan. Again, fighting the Taliban. Well, about 2 years ago, outrage broke out in the military community when they learned we're now funding the Taliban. It started under Joe Biden after Abbeygate. You know, where the Taliban let that suicide bomber through on purpose and they slaughtered 13 of our service members? Yeah, turns out we'd been rewarding them with about $40 million a week in payments, because I don't know why. But those payments help to keep them in power. When the followers of the very popular, very widely listened to, military-oriented Sean Ryan podcast found out about this, they went on a crusade to stop it. If you're on X, you'll notice once or twice a month, the words Taliban will start trending. It's almost always outrage online that the funding of the Taliban continues week after week after week. The U.S. House of Representatives did the right thing, passing a bill to defund the Taliban, make funding the Taliban illegal, thus defunding it, not once, but twice. Kudos to Nancy Mace and Tim Burchett for sponsoring that and getting that done. And twice, it's been blocked. Never got a vote. Blocked by whom? The one man right now, single-handedly keeping the Taliban in power. Republican Majority Leader John Thune. Why on earth would you do this with our tax dollars? Well, a couple days ago, someone finally asked Senator Thune this.
Leader Thune, the House passed Tim Burchett's bill to defund the Taliban. I think it was 11 months ago. Every week that goes by, they get another $40 million. When can the American people expect to see a vote on this, and do you expect it to pass?
I don't know when. We don't have that on currently on the schedule here. And you said it's passed in the House?
Yes.
Okay. I have not seen it. If it's come over from the House, that's not something that we consider putting on the floor at this point.
Liar. There is no way. He didn't notice a bill passed by the House. Sorry. There's no way his people miss Taliban trending a couple times a month attached to his name. And there's no way he missed the fact that under almost every post he puts up, dedicated military members who watch their compatriots suffer and die attach Taliban bill funding reminders in the comment section. There's simply no way he doesn't know. He's not just an evil man, and I truly believe he's an evil man. He's a liar. He absolutely has to know he's blocking that bill. But did you catch the end part? Okay, well, by the end of the question and answer session, he knows we're funding the Taliban. Did you catch what he said there?
That's not something that we consider putting on the floor at this point.
So, having learned that we're now funding the people, really rewarding the people who killed 2,456 service members and injured 20,000, some of them catastrophically, we're not going to put that on the schedule. We'll just keep right on paying them, because who the heck knows why? Now, if you're thinking Taliban, that rings a bell. I've heard about them recently on the Battleground America podcast. Yes, that's from Sarah Curter, who has her own, she's former CIA analyst. She has her own private intelligence center, and she's been tracking what the Taliban's been up to. Training. Al-Qaeda terrorists. Multiple training camps. In fact, Bin Laden's own son is running the operation. Wait, isn't that why we originally invaded Afghanistan? Because they were sheltering Al-Qaeda training camps? Yeah, pretty much. And it looks like John Thune may be funding that as well. Insane thing number five. After two decades of Democrats assuring us that we are all Nazis for simply disagreeing with them, including all of our leaders, and that because we are Nazis, we need to be stopped by any means necessary, Democrats did something we'd never do. Elect a guy with an actual Nazi tattoo on his chest. No worse, it's an SS Totenkopf, the worst kind of Nazi. You know who the SS were, right? Street thugs. Who helped install the Nazis in power, yes, but they're most famous for running the concentration camps. And their symbol was the Totenkopf. You know the thing that Graham Plattner tattooed on his chest then, proudly wore for 18 years, told girlfriends he knew what it was, even his own campaign manager, when she quit, said, yeah, he knew what it was. But that is not the insane part. No, this is. Back in June, Janet Mills, the very popular governor of Maine, who was expected to win this primary for the U.S. Senate, walking away, dropped out. Why? Because Graham Plattner, the toxic male, Nazi-loving woman-hater, and folks, this is a guy whose ex-girlfriend says, yeah, he wanted me to calm down, so he locked me in a room overnight and wouldn't let me out. Okay, if a Republican did that, that would be kidnapping. But whatever. I'll stick to what's insane. What's insane is that when Graham Plattner crossed the 61% threshold in polling back in April, the very popular governor of Maine, his opponent, dropped out, saying she couldn't beat him. She was done. Well, in the last few weeks, as you've seen, all the truth, the dirty laundry about him has come out, even in the mainstream media, which, yeah, spent a couple months lying about the Nazi tattoo. But even CNN and MS Now were eventually forced to admit, yeah, that was real, and he seems to be a woman abuser. So I was wondering if he could pull it off, because Janet Mills' name is still on the ballot. I figured all of this was doing damage to him, and I hoped he could get 50%, because I want the whole country to get a really good look at what the Democrat Party is becoming before it's too late. And also, I think Susan Collins can beat him. So I was hoping he could pull 50% after all the damage, after all the coverage in the liberal media, that once liberals found out he was a Nazi, not enough of them would defect. But here's the shocker, folks. I thought his numbers would go down, like from 61% to, I don't know, 52, 54, something like that. They went up. That's what's so astonishing. He was at 61% in April. And the more that the left, the liberal Democrat base in Maine, learned about the Nazi Graham Plattner, the more they liked him. And he clocked in at 73% of the vote in the end. He went up. This is what everyone on our side is missing. We keep using words like despite. They're hypocritical. They, you know, support Plattner despite the Nazi No, we need to use the words because of. They support him because of. When they learned, he got more popular. Why is this going on? Folks, I swear everyone on the right ought to have a mandatory 10-minute session on Blue Sky, their app. Yeah, it would do us a world of good, because I think we fundamentally underestimate how evil, totalitarian, and insane the left has quickly become. Graham Plattner became more popular because there is an actual overt strain of Nazism running through the Democrat Party. Who were the Nazis? They were the German Socialist Workers Party. Check. He's a socialist who's also said he's a communist. But if you spend any time on Blue Sky, and it'll only take you 10, 15 minutes, you'll note an overt strain of anti-Semitism. It's everywhere. Everything is the Jews' fault. Socialism? Check. Jew hatred? Check. Propensity toward violence? Check. Folks, Graham Plattner became more popular when they found out everything about him was true, because he perfectly represents what the young left is becoming. And the election results prove it. Insane thing number four. I'll never forget the moment my childhood friend Elisa crystallized for me exactly what socialism was. Before, I'd thought of it as a misguided redistributive system. It's not, she said. It's a theft system. The party tricks the underclasses into giving them enough power so they can steal everything that's not nailed down. And communism, very much the same thing. Well, folks, you can absolutely see this in North Korea, where the leadership grows rich while the people starve. Vladimir Putin's stolen enough that he's a billionaire. Yeah, Maduro and his entire family, they own mansions in Florida that, by the way, the Democrats let them keep, but under Rubio have been confiscated. Why? While the Venezuelan people starve and women who have college degrees sell their bodies for sex to feed their kids, the Venezuelan communist slash socialist leadership was stealing everyone blind. It's a theft system. China does the same thing. It's not really a communist system, not by the book anyway. There's about 1,000 families that are the Chinese Communist Party, and they rob everybody else blind. If you're really well behaved, they might let you have a business franchise that makes you middle class. Again, an organized theft system backed by violence, spying, terror, and the threat of violence by the government, which, once it gets power, never gives it back to the people again. Why do I bring this up? Minnesota. This week, Governor Tim Walz and the guy who was supposed to stop the $9 billion in fraud in Minnesota, Attorney General Keith Ellison, were turned over to the DOJ. That's called a criminal referral. What that means is that J.D. Vance's fraud committee found evidence of a crime, specifically that they knew about the fraud, facilitated the fraud by their actions, and that there might be enough evidence to charge them criminally. If you think about it, the evidence is all there right before your face. There's no way Tim Walz would have dropped out of another run for governor if he didn't know what he did. He did. He's not running again. But none of that's the shocking part. No, the shocking part is how far it went in that House report. Over 30 whistleblowers who testified under oath before Congress described a system very much like Venezuela, very much like a third world regime, like the third world regime that Minnesota is becoming. Here's just one of them on Fox News.
Whistleblower telling Fox she faced retaliation after sounding the alarm about fraud inside the state government, as the White House refers top Minnesota Democrats like Governor Tim Walz for a potential criminal investigation.
The vice president is calling on the Justice Department to investigate whether Minnesota officials harassed or intimidated whistleblowers, and a state employee tells Fox she faced retaliation for speaking up. Faye Bernstein is her name, a 20-year state employee who worked in behavioral health services. She says she warned state leaders about weak oversight of contracts and grants years before the fraud scandals came to light. Bernstein says she was eventually sidelined, ostracized, and placed on investigatory leave. She told the House Oversight Committee she worked in an environment where employees feared being labeled racist for questioning fraud or mismanagement.
Oh, it was very intimidating. You lived in fear of being called racist. And that is life-changing. That changes how you walk around in the world and how you do your work. I am not confident speaking up about things anymore.
The House Oversight Committee says it interviewed nearly 30 Minnesota whistleblowers. Some allege that after reporting fraud, DHS investigators photographed their homes and vehicles, monitored their phones, and sought information about their children.
Dude, as we used to say in the 1990s, DHS investigators, who's that? That's the Department of Health in Minnesota. Those are fraud investigators. They're actually deputized. They're law enforcement. They're the ones who are supposed to be going after the Somali fraud. But instead, since Somalis are such high-value Democrat voters and they bundle votes in large numbers, well, the actual police went after the actual whistleblowers to protect the fraudsters. But that's not even the most insane part. Now, the most insane part is how far it went, or almost went, before the Trump administration discovered the level of fraud going on in Minnesota and began to crack down. John Solomon has that news. Folks, this is from the House report.
The other thing that we found out, the Minnesota state government, as part of its retaliation, was thinking of using military officers, people in the National Guard, to spy on state workers or to retaliate against them. The findings have been referred to the Vice President J.D. Vance, who's out overseeing that fraud task force that on a daily basis now is ginning up prosecutions all across this country.
And there you have why Tim Walz isn't running again for governor. But folks, think what this is, okay? This is the natural continuation of the George Floyd era, where Democrats have fallen in love with criminals, insist they roam the streets, no matter how badly they hurt or kill people. Yeah, okay. But now it's extending to fraud. Basically, if you are the right people, you are a correct Democrat voting group, a high value Democrat voting group, they simply cannot bring themselves to stop you from robbing federal taxpayers blind. In fact, they are willing, or at least have considered, using violence to do it, using military power to do it. And they were already using the police state to do it. That's who DHI is, the Department of Health Inspector. So they are the, you know, again, deputized police of that agency used to intimidate people. Folks, that is an authoritarian regime. Those are the exact tactics you expect to be in use from Cuba to Venezuela. It's the left's oldest playbook. And that, folks, is why I call these blue cities and states post-American, post-constitutional territories. Yes, geographically still in America, but otherwise not so much. Insane thing number three kind of explains why places like Minneapolis are now more closely resembling Venezuela than they are America, because Democrats don't want to live in America. A new poll confirms what we've suspected all along about the modern Democrat Party. They're the only group of people in America who don't want to live in America. A majority, 55%, tell Elon University and YouGov in a poll out this week, in answer to the question, is there any other country on earth you would rather live in than the United States today? 55% say yes, there's another country, versus 45% no. No other group is close. For Republicans, it's 90-10, and independents, 62-38. And you can see why they'd be uncomfortable here. They'd rather go somewhere with no prosperity, nobody's rich, no free speech, and no capitalism. Because another poll out this week showed an all-time low for Democrats. Just 42% have a favorable opinion of capitalism. That's down from more than a majority in 2010. And here's the scary part, folks. In 2010, 50% of Democrats had a positive view of socialism. Fast forward to 2026, 66% do. No wonder they feel uncomfortable in America. Which leads us to insane thing number two. And the real, and folks, what this shows you is the absolute determination of the Democrats to make this another country by using every single lever of power and breaking so many laws, I've lost track. Every week, we have a new shocking fraud statistic that's been uncovered by DOGE working in the background in the Trump administration. This week's is no less shocking than any other week. The number is 20,000. 20,000 HUD houses, HUD housing units occupied by illegal immigrants. Folks, what's so astonishing about that is it's illegal. Folks, again, Bill Clinton signed the law, 1995. Illegal immigrants cannot get welfare benefits in the United States of America, including subsidized housing. But there are at least 24,000 of them living in more than 20,000 housing units. And before we're done here, the numbers could go higher because the HUD housing secretary this week told Fox News that there's another, get this, 200,000 that were let in by Joe Biden after his administration suspended the fraud protections. So 200,000 people moved in who never were checked to see what their immigration status is or if they even qualified. Folks, that's an amazing body of work for just 4 years under Joe Biden. Here's Fox News. But the good news here is twofold. Yes, it's very sad that Americans should have been living in those units, but were somehow shoved to the back of the line once again, which just keeps happening with the Democrats. But the good news is Trump's got them. And according to HUD Secretary Scott Turner, they're in the process of kicking these people out. Another great stat this week, the 4 million that have been kicked off food stamps. 4 million. Wow. Folks, we are making progress. I know when you hear these things, it probably makes you mad, but understand this is the healing process. You discover it, they move them off. And folks, we've got an army with which to fight now. Thanks to, hilariously, the Democrats. Fox News reporter Bill Malusian writes, what was the end result of the Democrats' Department of Homeland Security shutdown? You know, the one where they left people jammed for hours risked flyer safety, no TSA funding, you know, selfish Democrat stuff. Yeah, what'd they get for that? That DHS shutdown? Zero ICE reforms. And ICE and Customs and Border Patrol are now funded with an additional $70 billion through the rest of Trump's presidency. Mnuchin writes, and this is on top of the money ICE and Customs and Border Patrol already got in the One Big Beautiful Bill last year. ICE and Customs and Border Patrol now have more money coming to their coffers than they ever would have if there had been no Department of Homeland Security shutdown. Thank you, Democrats. But in practical terms for you, what does this mean? You get to be safe for another 3 years. Another 3 years where the border won't be thrown open. And God knows who wanders in here to do God knows what, with the Department of Homeland Security not paying any attention because they're weaponized and turned against us, the good, peace-loving people of the United States of America who just happen to not vote Democrat. Finally, insane thing number one. Truly an historic moment in American history this week. Just about everybody missed it. When the media is talking oil right now, it's all bad news because they're the media. They skip the biggest oil news this week. Again, truly historic. The United States of America on June 11th, 2026, became the world's largest oil exporter, surpassing Saudi Arabia and Russia, hitting a record high of 10.5 million barrels per day, driven by strong shale production, innovation in the private sector, all-time high refining output. And folks, production-wise, this marks our third consecutive month at the top. And the reason that this is a first for us, even though we're in month three, is that the export number, not the production number, but the export number went so high. That's according to Reuters. I'll attach the source at the end of the podcast. Did you catch that part there? This marked the third consecutive month at the top. That's for production. And now for export. Huh. That matches the Iran war time period exactly, doesn't it? This represents a historic shift, according to Mies. U.S. was already the world's top oil producer for years. But until recently, Saudi Arabia and sometimes Russia, depending on the month, led in exports. Not anymore. We are producing and exporting oil, as I've been telling you, flat out, at total top capacity. We could not produce another barrel. We rarely do that as a country. A lot of it has to do with, well, you know, revenues versus expenses and fluctuations in the price of a barrel. This is the story of the Iran war, and the Iran war is the story of oil. That oil is lifeblood for us because every barrel is sold for dollars. And folks, why do we become the top exporter? Easy. Because Iran is terrorizing the Strait. Yes, we learned this week that Trump and the military have been secretly escorting through about 20 ships a day, but it doesn't matter. There were about 2,000 jammed up and waiting to go through. So what's that? Well, he said we've, you know, about 100 million we have snuck through the Strait under Iran's nose. Well, that's cool and all. But folks, that's about one day worth of world oil use over the last couple of months or so. So yes, it helped, but it's not significant. What is significant is what Trump's not talking about, or at least not much, is all those cargo ships headed to the United States of America because they can't get through the Strait. Remember all those years, Donald Trump trying to get Europe to buy not just oil from us, but natural gas? And by the way, you know, 14% of Europe's natural gas went, past tense, went through the Strait. Where do you think they're getting a lot of it now? Mm-hmm. They're coming to the Gulf of America. And here's what's happening, folks. It's not just them buying our light sweet crude. It's also countries bringing cargo of unrefined oil to our refineries. It's countries now picking up, because that's how long we've gone now, picking up refined oil they dropped off. All of which used to run through the Strait. So that's why we're running flat out right now. That's why we have just broken the record, the world's largest oil exporter. What happens the longer the Iran war drags on, the longer Iran terrorizes the Strait, the harder set those supply lines those relationships become. What else happens the longer that Iran is allowed? Because Trump is letting them do it. Don't make any mistake. I'll explain that in a minute. The longer that Trump allows them to terrorize the Strait and those supply lines keep running, the more permanent that they become. But what else happens? Well, if you were paying attention this week, you watched Trump take $700 million out of the Treasury and pump it into the coal industry. He's not just giving it away. It's being used for a specific purpose. In fact, he has invoked war powers to do it. And that is to open up the shuttered coal plants that Obama shut down. Perfectly good coal plants that produce some of the cleanest burning coal on Earth. We desperately need them to reduce the cost of production and compete with the Indian and Chinese factories overseas. So I'm glad he's doing it. We've got to get them up and running and establish them so that it makes it harder for the Democrats to shut them down in the future. But back to oil. Trump needed startup capital for that too. Billions. Because remember, folks, a lot of those refineries, particularly in the Gulf, have been shut down. Part of it was they used to refine the Venezuelan oil that we've now taken as well. And then China took that. We didn't have it anymore. And I've explained that to you before. That was a disaster because that's viscous oil. That's not the kind you put in your car. That's the kind that you need for manufacture of just about everything on Earth. We don't have a lot of that. So we used to refine that in the Gulf and get it from Venezuela. Then China took it once we sanctioned it. Stupidly, and I've explained that in the past, China swooped in violation of international sanctions and got it for pennies on the dollar and then used it to beat our manufacturing companies that then had to pay world market prices. See, I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but now a lot of that oil is coming to those refineries to be processed, as well as oil that was never coming to our refineries before. It was moving through the straits. Now it's here. What is that? One massive shot in the arm. Billions of dollars worth of, yes, revenue, but also capital, both into our shale producers, really at every node in the production pipeline. Our refiners, our shale producers, our frackers, those who move the oil, the logistics, I mean, every part of that system. So what does this headline mean? Big GDP growth. If you've listened to me for a very long time, I made a point of this, as wonky as it was, every single quarter of the last Trump administration, to point out the number one growth sector in the U.S. economy. If you went around a grocery store or something and asked people, hey, what do you think the number one growth sector of the American economy is? They'd probably tell you tech. It's not. It's the mining and minerals category. And it was every quarter under Trump. If you want to belt out GDP, if you want to create real jobs in actual industry, what do? You drag the Iran war out. I'm not saying that's what he's deliberately doing. It could be just more Trump taco. That's the trending acronym most days now on X. Trump says he's going to blow up Iran and then just doesn't. Trump always chickens out. That's what it stands for. Maybe that's what's going on. But if you deal in hard, cold facts, whatever Trump's motivation is, it's going gangbusters for the American oil industry. Again, hitting that new record of June 11, 2026, becoming the world's largest oil exporter. That ends when the Strait reopens, unless we can really sink and set those supply chains. Even when it does end, or if it does end sometime soon, there will still have been a multi-billion dollar infusion of capital into those industries that they can use to expand. Now, look at the facts on the ground, because facts are stubborn things. Trump has said two completely contradictory things. It's actually driving me nuts that we decimated Iran. Their Navy's at the bottom of the sea. They don't have an Air Force anymore. They don't have a military. They're done. We've defeated them. But he's also said, and I can't play this audio enough, point blank, that we only destroyed 70% of the military targets. 30% more remain. If you're a Fox News listener, you know this is damn near driven General Jack Keane and General Kellogg to distraction because it's about 2 weeks of bombing left. If you listen to Netanyahu, he uses the same figure, 2 weeks of bombing left. In other words, Trump has, for all of his carping about, well, we took out the military, the Navy, whatever. In that one statement, Trump admitted the truth. He deliberately left them alive, left them in power, and left them armed. And folks, I'm not talking about the targets here that would be heartbreaking, like taking out the bridges and the power plants, because that really would hurt the Iranian people. No, no, no. I'm talking legitimate military targets. You want proof? Okay, I'll give you proof. When Trump was forced to retaliate this week, and he didn't want to, but when Trump was forced to retaliate against Iran this week, what did he hit? One IRGC military facility and two radar facilities. Facilities that have been up and running this whole time. Why were they up and running this whole time? Well, folks, you don't just stick a ballistic missile on a launcher like a firecracker and light it on fire. You need radar targeting to fire that stuff. And listen to the news accounts. Why can't those tankers go through? Why can't the cargo ships go through? You'll see the words mosquito boats. As in, you know how easy it is to swat a mosquito? We could blow them away. But we don't in the street. Odd, because we do in the Caribbean. We don't seem to have any problem doing it at all. Why? Well, we target them with satellites and kaboom. But somehow in the Strait of Hormuz, we just can't seem to knock them out. And folks, we don't unless they actually open fire on a ship or do damage. Then we'll take them out afterward. You think we can hit rewind on our satellites, see where they are, follow them back to the shore and kabloom? Now watch again, because there's a, whatever peace deal we signed. What a joke. It's not going to be peace. Everybody knows that. In fact, it's driving everybody nuts. Iran's going to continue with another 13,500 strikes, because that's the number they fired since the ceasefire. And only after they actually hit something will we retaliate against military targets we could have taken out in the first place to prevent those strikes. None of this is an accident. On Fox News this week, Don Teichert, who's the former Middle Eastern attaché, as I said earlier, from Trump's first administration, pointed out there's still a ton of military targets ringing the strait that we've never taken out. He begged Trump to hit them. So while Trump may either be taco or playing some kind of brilliant economic strategic game here, he's also taking an insane risk. Because when Abbeygate happened in Afghanistan, the death unnecessarily of those 13 troops, Biden's approval rating sank and it never recovered. His presidency never came back from it. Iran doesn't have to beat us militarily. They get 13 of our troops. When Trump has done this, accommodated them like this, it could end him. In much the way Biden's fecklessness with the Taliban ended his presidency years before he ever tapped out and didn't run again. Trump is taking a huge risk with our troops' lives, and I resent the hell out of it. And while he is at a almost ridiculous level not kicking ass on the battlefield anymore, he is economically. Which, should we actually sign this peace deal this weekend, won't change Iran's behavior one iota. They'll behave exactly on Sunday the way they did before they signed the peace deal on Saturday, and Trump will run around trying his best not to notice. Pray they don't finally get in that hit they've been trying so hard for and take out some of our troops. Because this is one heck of a dangerous game of chicken. Maybe also a foolish game of chicken, but a strategically brilliant game of chicken.
Battleground America with Tara Servatius. Please subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Share with friends, family, and other free thinkers. Thanks for listening.